Rocket Companies said today it will acquire personal finance app Truebill for $1.275 billion in cash. Truebill was founded in 2015 and currently has 2.5 million members that use the platform to manage subscriptions and other bills. Joining us now for a first on Yahoo Finance interview is Rocket Company CEO Jay Farner. Jay, good to see you. You weren't kidding a couple weeks ago when you told us that you were on the hunt for acquisitions. Congrats on this one. What's the play here?
Yeah, thanks so much. We're super excited. You know, if you look at Truebill, you mentioned it, 2.5 million members. This is really what we consider a next generation personal finance app. For our client base, we talk to millions of people a year. We've got $350 billion of mortgage originations that we'll be doing this year. And a small percent of the people we talk to can be helped with a mortgage. They can be helped with a personal loan. They can be helped with a car. But the vast majority of people that we talk to aren't ready to transact yet. So how do we assist them? How do we stay engage with those clients? Well, Truebill answers that question, right? Our clients want to save money. Truebill helps people save money. They've got credit improvement. They've got subscription cancellation services. They've got bill saving services. So budgeting, all of the things that we need to do to take that billion-dollar marketing budget and keep those clients engaged in our funnel, we accomplish with Truebill. So a really exciting day for us, and should really help Rocket Companies continue this platform vision that we've got and grow.
Jay, I would say you've been on a little bit of a crusade late in this year to get a higher stock multiple for Rocket Companies. You've said you have wanted a fintech multiple, and is that part of the reason why you made this deal?
Yeah, when I look at Dave, when I look at Acorns, when I think about these other next generation finance apps, I think Truebill's right there, does an amazing job. The clients that are participating, the members love it, and it gives us reoccurring revenue. So we've got about $1.3 billion of cash coming in on a yearly basis from servicing. So every month people are making those payments to us. But adding this, $100 million of additional reoccurring revenue and now growing with the base that we've got our origination revenue, but now we've got this reoccurring revenue as well, and I think that will help our multiple. More importantly, it accomplishes our mission. It grows the platform. It engages consumers. It allows us to leverage the marketing spend. And so we know stock's going to go up and down, and we'll continue to buy it back if we see it's a great price to do so, like we've been doing. But we're focused on the future, and this Truebill acquisition allows us to accomplish those goals.
Hey, Jay, it's Julie here. Is Truebill also a more interest rate increase resistant business?
So if you think about the lifetime value of our clients, at some point in time, we're going to help them with a purchase. In fact, about 25, 26% of Truebill's clients own a home, which is great news and will help them save money on their home. But the other 70-plus percent don't own a home. These are millennials, Gen Z. 65, 66% of millennials say they're worried about their finances. 80-plus percent say they want to purchase a home. So if we have this app, this engagement funnel that allows us to plug in their bank account, 2.5 million of Truebill's clients have already engaged their bank account to Truebill. So every day the data is coming in about deposits they're receiving, about withdrawals they're making. All of that data will allow us to know when it's right to help those clients with a mortgage, help them buy a home, help them with a personal loan. So it really becomes about servicing the client, and it takes away the volatility of interest rates. So we grow our business, and we get that reoccurring revenue. We get that membership, or Rocket Prime is how we're thinking about it. I mean, all of these things continue to change our company into that fintech platform that we've been discussing.
And Jay, some of my contacts on the street were expecting Rocket to come out with a special dividend soon. Does this deal push that off the table?
No. We're very fortunate. We've been in business for 36 plus years, always profitable. And as we've talked about before, we continue to make money. We continue to have cash. And so we've been buying our stock back. We'll continue to do that when it's the right thing to do. We continue to invest in things like Truebill to grow our platform, to grow our client base, to grow the lifetime value of our clients. But also making a special dividend remains on the table as well. We've got billions of dollars of cash, and we're always thinking about the right move to make to reward our shareholders, but also grow our company for the long run.
A couple weeks ago, Jay, you presented at a Goldman Sachs conference, and something caught my eye. You said you had pretty big days for your core mortgage business on Black Friday and Cyber Monday. That's not something I'm used to hearing from a lot of players in your industry. What's the demand look like right now?
Well, I think the 10-year Treasury here is now back down below 1.4. And so interest rates are incredibly low. We feel great about where we're going to be in 2022. The desire to purchase homes will remain strong, but the ability to save money is incredibly strong as well. I think people are worried that rates have ticked up a little bit, but when you're in the threes, there's plenty of opportunity to rate and term refinance somebody. There's also plenty of opportunity for people to take cash out of their home. We've got $25, $26 trillion of equity in the market right now, and so as people think about saving, we just saw that reports came out that savings is actually dropping a little bit. So as consumers think about ways to pay off debt, ways to improve their home, as we've got Truebill as another way to engage with them, to help them budget and see that they need to do these things. You know, 2022 is looking up to be a great year for our business, at least for Rocket. We feel very strong about where we're headed.
Well, congrats on the deal. Look forward to catching up with you in the new year. Rocket Company CEO Jay Farner. We'll talk to you soon.
'21 already shaping up to be one of the most active IPO years.
Talking about companies like Warby Parker, Allbirds.
We went for a run with the team. We ran to the New York Stock Exchange, got to ring the opening bell. What else can you dream of?
We're going to have this IPO kind of bring Vizio into the next chapter. We're really excited about where we're going from here.
This is going to be a super, super dynamic year for us. And you're going to see the changes in terms of market share and growth and all that.
We wanted to create an amazing foundation. So we did some things the hard way.
And we wanted to create a brand that really disrupted fast food and made it healthy.
And so we were able to grow in spite of the challenges and the headwinds from the pandemic. Frankly, we feel like we're emerging stronger.
In the end, it's about bringing a perfect product and the perfect running feeling to the market, and this is what we're focused on.
On Holdings has been off to the races since a sizzling debut on the New York Stock Exchange back in mid-September. The company recently reported that third quarter sales surged 68% from a year ago, and profit margins nearly expanded 600 basis points. Let's check in on what On has on tap for next year with co-CEO and CFO Martin Hoffman and co-CEO Mark Maurer. Guys, good to see you again. Thanks for taking some time. Mark, I'll start with you here. How's the holiday season going?
It's amazing. We actually just came back from skiing, but we couldn't be happier than spending this afternoon with you.
And Martin, over to you. You know, the holiday season has started pretty well. It looks like the malls have been crowded. What are you seeing from an inflation standpoint?
I mean, we just came out of a very strong third quarter. It actually has been the strongest one in the history of the company, not only in top line but also gross profit and EBITDA margin. So we really see that there's a strong demand for the On brand across all channels, across all product categories, across all the different regions, and this also continued now into the holiday season. We just passed the Black Friday weekends and have seen very strong results there. At the same time, of course, Europe, many countries are going back into lockdown, so this is obviously something that we are feeling as well. So Asia is on the hindsight is doing very well. So it's a bit of mixed picture in the fourth quarter so far, but overall very, very happy where we are, and very, very strong feelings about the future. We just started our sell-in season for the second half of 2022 and get a lot of really positive feedback from our key retail partners all around the world on our existing products and our new products. So we are really positive about the future.
Yeah, you guys have seen incredible growth over the past couple of years. Mark, you guys, when you reported your earnings last month, you talked a little bit about supply chain and trying to diversify the supply chain a little bit more. Now that we're a month on those comments, I'm just curious how that's going, especially given what Martin was just talking about in terms of this latest wave of the virus.
Yeah, you know, I think for us, it's been very important since a long time to be extremely agile and nimble on how we're approaching things. And what you're seeing right now is you're seeing a lot of disruptions on the demand side, but then also on the supply side, lots of disruptions in the freight market. And so what we've been up to is really kind of balancing that out. We continue to diversify. We're entering new countries. We're actually in January and February above the capacity that we originally planned back in June. So we're very, very happy on where we stand from a supply perspective.
And you guys have also been diversifying in terms of product, right? When you reported your last quarter, your apparel sales are way up as a percentage of your overall sales. And I'm curious what the goal is for that side of the business. In other words, what is the, Martin, I'll ask this one to you. What does the appropriate mix look like for you between apparel and footwear?
Well, we're looking less at the mix. So apparel is obviously at a very earlier stage than our footwear business. We started with apparel back in 2016, but it's growing much stronger than footwear. So it will be a very important pillar of growth for the future. And we're very excited about many new products that are coming next year, especially in the area of buttons and insulated jackets and outer layers. But at the same time, our footwear business is still extremely strong across running, outdoor, performance all day. So for us, it's about growing all the different businesses, but less about how much share apparel will be in the future.
Yeah, Mark, I know the team puts a lot of pride in its innovation and the product pipeline as well. What's your biggest innovation that we need to be on the lookout for next year?
I mean, there's lots to come, but definitely I want to highlight Clean Cloud, which we announced, where we basically take carbon emissions and we're intending to make a midsole and outsole out of that. Please look out and watch out for Cyclone, which is our fully recyclable and circular product that comes in a subscription model. Very, very important. But then we're also looking at amazing innovation in the running space. So we're relaunching the Cloud. We're bringing a Cloud Monster, a Cloud Runner. And all of these products come with a way higher share of sustainable materials than in the past. So we're very, very happy with that progress. And we're very happy that we can, you know, continue to ignite the human spirit through movement and bring an amazing feeling to runners' feet.
Guys, I want to ask you both, now that you have been a public company for several months, how that's been, if there is anything that's particularly surprised you about the difference between being public and being privately held, if there's any big learning that you have taken away. I mean, I want to get both of your takes on that. Martin, let's get you first on this.
Well, first of all, I think the IPO itself was a very emotional moment for all of us. And I think we were very fortunate that we hit the moment where actually our teams all around the world could at least meet in the office and celebrate that moment a bit before we now all have to separate again. So there was a lot of positive energy that came out of it. And at the same time, we are at a new starting line of delivering on our mission to ignite the human spirit through movement. So it maybe took like 2 weeks of digesting that whole situation. And then we all fully went back into the business and the opportunities that we have there. And also the volatility that we see on the supply side, but overall we really see that it ignited a lot of positive energy into the company and into our partners as well. We've just been at the running event in Austin, one of the biggest trade shows for Run Specialty, and also there was a lot of positive feedback and pride from our retail partners about that milestone.
Yeah, it's always good to meet those people in person. What about you, Mark?
Yeah, I think, look, we exist, as Martin said, to ignite the human spirit through movement. And we have a big dream to bring millions and millions and millions more into that. And the IPO really helps us to have the funds and the opportunities available to do so. And I think already since the IPO, we've been able to announce a few things. We've been able, like Clean Cloud that I just spoke about, we've been able to celebrate successes with a podium in the Berlin Marathon. And we can take that and, you know, we can bring it back to the athletes. We can create even better product, even faster product. We're expanding our distribution with some of the biggest retailers. We're doing pilots with JD and Foot Locker, and this is all very, very positive. So, you know, in the end, as Martin said, it's a new starting line, and it's a huge motivation to everyone to make this way, way bigger than what it is today.
And guys, I was slated to be in your neck of the woods soon for the World Economic Forum in Davos, but now that has since been canceled because of the pandemic.
Very sorry.
What are you seeing?
Yeah, no, I
You could have shown me how to ski for sure. But what are you seeing on the ground there in Switzerland? Is your team back in the office? Are you seeing less mobility? What are you seeing?
No, so now it's mandatory home office again. Everyone is back in the home office, but also in the outdoors, which was already a positive momentum in the last lockdowns. But anyway, we are approaching now the holiday season, so I think it's also a moment where the team deserves to switch off for a moment and to recover. They have done an amazing job over the last 12 months. And then hopefully everyone comes back fully energized to dream on in 2022.
And let me just very quickly add, I think it's, you know, we've seen that in the past, in the last 2 years, that, you know, lockdowns and kind of that being bound to a home place also triggers the need to go out and run. So I think, you know, over the last 2 years, we've seen that this also gives a very, very positive momentum in the end to our products and, you know, to the movement that we're trying to create. We're ready to tackle what's to come, and we want to help people to get out and move.
All right. Well, stay safe on the slopes. Stay safe out there in general. Look forward to talking with you both next year. On Holdings co-CEO and CFO Martin Hoffman and co-CEO Mark Marr. We'll talk to you soon.
With concerns about the immediate outlook for the restaurant industry, hospitality platform Union is looking to lend a helping hand. The all-in-one app is set to increase restaurant revenue by up to 30% and can reduce customer wait time by 80%. Let's bring in Alex Broecker, Union founder and CEO. Alex, it's good to talk to you. You get the sense that there's a lot of restaurant owners that are looking at the headlines around the Omicron variant right now, saying, here we go again. I'm just curious what you have heard from restaurants in terms of foot traffic, to what extent they've already been affected from those who say, maybe I'm going to rethink my restaurant plans.
Yeah, I think there's terror across the industry again. What's going to happen? Are we going to go back into a shutdown mode? They barely survived the first two waves of the pandemic, and now we're facing uncertainty yet again. So across the board, there's certainly some panic and terror across our portfolio.
We've really adapted new habits throughout the pandemic in terms of, you know, what we do when we go out to eat. And a lot of us familiar now with the QR code because the menus are no longer there as well. You've talked about the return of that, the big bounce back that we have seen. What kind of growth has that spurred?
Amazing growth across the board, not only growth for our company, but just guest satisfaction, restaurant sales, as you mentioned, reduced wait times. It's a situation where 6 years of consumer technology adoption and payments happened in 6 months. You show a QR code to every consumer, they know exactly what to do now. And frankly, it saved and can save the hospitality industry.
I mean, talk to me about the cost savings that you see. What restaurants have been able to take out as a result of that technology in place?
Yeah, there's a huge, as we talk about the great resignation, a million hospitality workers are never coming back to this industry. And so as a result, in the restaurant business, how many times have we all walked into a restaurant where an entire section is now closed? Or you sit down to have what you think is going to be a great experience at your favorite restaurant, now that you finally get to go out again, and you wait 10 minutes for a server to walk up to you. And so you, as a result, negative reviews at restaurants are up 800%, and it's all due to the staffing shortage. And so as a result, negative reviews are up, sales are down because you don't have servers to actually serve those guests. And moreover, your guests are just upset because they're having a bad service expectation. So integrated commerce platforms like Union, which were born to really kind of all out of the same block of aluminum, have an exceptional guest experience, an exceptional ordering experience, exceptional loyalty experience right when you walk in the door, is what how we started the company, what we're bringing back to restaurants to hopefully save the industry.
Yeah, I mean, you hate to see the restaurants going through the same thing they've been experienced over the last 2 years of the pandemic. But what you just described there seems to suggest a significant upside for Union specifically. What's the outlook going into 2022?
Yeah, 100%. We're just crossing 1,000 venues now. We think with our technology platform, we'll be in over 4,000 venues by the end of next year, all in a win-win situation for the venue owners, that can get back to operating the way that they should be with 75% less staff. So I think it's going to be a huge win for Union and a huge win for our customers.
And, you know, finally, I've heard you say a few times talking about the technology in the staffing shortages. And, you know, we've talked a lot about potential automation, how technology could really start to fill some of that void in the face of these labor shortages. How much of that do you think is going to be permanent? How do you see this restaurant experience evolving as a result of what we're going through right now?
Yeah, great question. I don't think we're going to go back. I don't think there's going to be a huge resurgence in staff. The staffing shortages will continue. And in terms of guest experience and enjoyment, they're now used to ordering and paying when they want. The average guest on our platform now orders in 42 seconds once they sit down, compared to 8 to 10 minutes in a traditional experience. That's better for customers. They get to order when they want. Better for the venue owners. They get increased sales. And better for the staff, because when sales go up, their tips go up. So I think this is here to stay. And in terms of removing inefficient processes around the order and the payment, when you think about in the US particularly, we still hand a credit card to a stranger who walks away for 10 minutes to bring you back your card so you can sign it. It's crazy when you think about that, that still occurs in this country. And so we believe that the inefficient processes of ordering when the guest wants, paying when the guest wants, are here to stay.
Yeah, it is interesting to see when you think about how things are done internationally, especially in Asia in terms of payments, but significant leaps we made on that front. Alex Broecker, Union founder and CEO, appreciate the time today.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance. Well, luxury resale is having its moment in the sun as more fashion savvy look to acquire their perfect it bag without busting their wallet. And here to help us discuss the resale boom is Sarah Davis, Fashion File founder, president, and chief creative officer. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us today. So this astronomical rise in prices of luxury brands, I'm assuming that can only help your cause, right? But what are some of the other driving factors that are attracting people to come to Fashion File?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, obviously, it does help us. We appreciate that they care so much about their brand and really looking at those supply, kind of keeping a really tight watch on their supply and distribution. But today, there's so much thought into really making conscious shopping choices and circularity, sustainability. And so people are really thinking about that before they make investments and make purchases, and that's helping us. And then obviously supply chain issues in the secondary market and resale, we don't have, our inventory isn't sitting on, you know, containers out in Long Beach Harbor. So I think that all of those kind of tailwinds together are really pushing us forward, and our growth has accelerated even faster than ever, even though we're 22 years into this business. So.
And can you break some of that growth down by, let's say, demographics? In your notes, you're talking about Gen Zers and their affection for luxury goods, how that's risen over the last couple of years. Any details you can share there?
Yeah, it's fascinating because our target market has always been our regular customer. Again, we've been doing this a long time, and so we've got to know her very well. And it's usually 24 to 34 year old demographic, fairly diverse. But what we've found that's super interesting is in the last year, our audience of 18 to 24 year olds has increased five times, grew five times as fast. So we're very excited about the orders that they're making, and kind of, I think that what is driving that group is two things. Number one, like I said, circularity and sustainability has kind of like brought this to mind and given a lot of awareness to the industry. And then they're honestly looking for a deal. It's a way to get access to a category that maybe they didn't have access to not that long ago. And it's kind of fun. When people are shopping now, they're thinking about the secondary purchase when they buy from the primary market, even, or if they buy from the secondary market, kind of like how we used to do with cars, where you're like, okay, I'm looking at two cars. This one has better resale value, so I might pay a little more for it because I can sell for more later, especially with that younger group, the 18 to 24, but on up, people are thinking, you know what, I could buy this vintage Chanel flap because when I sell it in a couple of years, I'm basically going to sell it for what I bought it for. It's almost like a free bag.
Yeah, and there are certain bags that you know will just hold their price no matter what. Like, you know, I'm sure a Chanel bag or something like an Hermes Birkin bag, those things never go down in value. They only seem to go up. But I want to, you know, as you say, people are sort of buying these luxury items and they are thinking about reselling them. How does that work on your platform? Can you walk us through really quickly? If someone wants to sell an item, how does it get priced? You know, yeah. How much do they get back as a portion of the proceeds?
Yeah, this isn't a consignment business. This is, you know, it's a new model where you're using our app or our website, you're taking photos, you know, maybe you have a Gucci backpack that you bought a couple of years ago and you never really wore it. It's been sitting in your closet. Take some photos, you send it to us, and we're going to say we'll give you $1,000 for that item. If you like that offer, then we'll send you a free shipping label, and then you're going to stick that in the old Amazon box that you've got sitting out in your garage or something. Put our shipping label on it, send it to our facility here. I'm in our headquarters in Carlsbad, North County, San Diego right now. And as soon as we authenticate that item, then we're going to send you your check, or we could send you a wire. We can pay you. We were bootstrapped for 20 years, but we partnered with Neiman Marcus in 2019 as our first investor. And so we could pay you a Neiman Marcus store credit. There's lots of ways we could do that. But then we sell everything online. The world is our marketplace. And yeah.
And Sarah, something you said a minute ago reminded me of a different situation. So let me just recap. You said some of your customers might be buying luxury goods that they expect to be able to resell in a couple of years, maybe for the same price. And that's based on the high inflation that we're seeing right now. And in the 1970s, there is an analog where people would buy European sports cars. And because of the devaluing U.S. dollar, they would be able to sell them for the same price in a number of years. So I'm just wondering, how much do you think inflation is on the minds of your customers? And is that really one of their biggest considerations?
It's actually interesting because obviously inflation plays a part, but when you've got brands that literally, you know, these brands are raising their prices every year, year over year, since, you know, they made that particular style. If you look at a Chanel flap, since it was introduced, every single year, they produce basically the same style bag. They produce them in limited quantities, and they raise the price throughout time, and they raise the price in line with inflation again. But this is something we've seen historically over time. And so you might have a bag, a Chanel flap, jumbo flap that you bought for, you know, under $2,000, you know, in the early 2000s. And then we're able, over time, as this price has gone up, now that bag is over $7,000 at retail. And so you could see how we would offer you more than you bought it for. The thing that's kind of interesting too, is that you see this behavior in the sneaker world where you buy sneakers and the prices go up. But what's great about the things that we sell in this building is that you actually can wear them. So I'm not talking about buying a Chanel flap and sitting it on your, you know, in your closet and don't touch it. Don't, you know, don't crease the box or don't, you know, take the tags off. No, you can take that bag, keep good care of it. We always say leather's a skin. So you want to like moisturize it, keep it clean or whatever, but just minor, keep it good care of it. And that's going to continue to go up in price over time.
I protect my bags with my life, but the only problem is I can't resell any of them because my daughters take them all and then they disappear. I don't know where they go. We will have to leave it there. I know you say that you are expecting much more growth and are planning to open a 60,000 square foot authentication center as well. Thank you so much for your time today.
We here at Yahoo Finance, like most financial journalists, love our charts. And I'm sure you do too. We got to tell you, what are the most important charts that you want to watch next year to figure out the direction of the economy and the markets? Well, for that, we need a little help from an old friend. Sam Rowe is the editor of the TKR.co and wrote up some of these charts and flagged some of these charts for us. Sam, good to see you. Happy holidays. Let's take a look at the one of these that you flagged, and that's job openings, which jolts, in other words. This thing has gotten sort of unprecedented attention over the past couple of years. It never was the primary chart, and it's just gained a lot of importance.
Yeah, no, it really has. It's I guess, you know, the jolts, the job openings and labor turnover survey, which sort of lags the official employment report by a month, has gotten a lot of attention because it's captured all the turnover that's been going on, you know, in the labor market since the beginning of the pandemic. You know, a lot of the other metrics like quits rates and all this stuff has been getting a lot of attention, but job openings, you know, is just incredibly interesting. I mean, you know, you think about the state of the economy right now and the stock market and earnings, and you do hear about a lot of positive things happening about how consumer spending is, you know, back to new record highs and GDP is back to record levels. But we have 11 million job openings, and job openings, you know, an employer doesn't put out a job opening unless, you know, they're trying to fill some sort of unmet demand. And so job openings is an incredibly bullish leading indicator in that, you know, there are a whole lot of businesses saying that we need more people to, you know, conduct business, to manufacture goods, to, you know, serve customers as they come into our store, or diners when they come into our restaurants. So I think this is going to be an, you know, very important one to watch, because as long as those job openings are high, it's signaling to us that, you know, there's still a lot of demand that's being unmet in the economy.
Sam, I know you're also watching delivery times, because really one of the stories of this year has been supply chain problems.
Yeah, I think, you know, delivery times probably captures, you know, the supply chain issue, you know, most succinctly. And yeah, they're all elevated. Like, you know, the indicators are starting to turn lower a bit, but they're still extremely elevated. And one of the things that's really interesting about supplier delivery times is it has a pretty tight correlation. Like that specific chart that, you know, shows that elevated level based off of manufacturing and purchasing manager surveys, is it's very tightly correlated to inflation rates. And so what that suggests is, you know, as supply chains improve and those delivery times get better, we could see some, you know, significant relief in the inflation rate.
So there are lots of different ways to sort of slice and dice that stuff, right, to try and figure out what's happening with the supply chain and the effect it's having on companies. And one of your other charts is another side of that, another nuance of that, the inventories to sales ratio, because we know that that inventories have been falling. This is, I hadn't seen this particular chart though. This is a cool one in terms of looking at that ratio.
Yeah, inventory of sales is just, again, it's another one of these stories that, you know, I guess it's probably something that the consumer sees a little bit more. When you go to a store and, you know, they don't have something in green, so you buy it in navy, or they, you know, the bulk size, you know, oatmeal isn't for sale, so you buy the individual packets instead. Yeah, I mean, this is all a result of both a combination of tight supply chains as well as, you know, really strong demand from, you know, consumers and businesses. But, you know, what's really interesting about, you know, inventory levels and inventory to sales ratios is, you know, even if you have a situation where, you know, the end demand is, you know, cools off a little bit, businesses, stores, warehouse, you know, all these, you know, entities that have deflated inventory levels are still going to need to restock these inventories because they just want to be better prepared for their customers when they do come through those doors. So the fact that inventories continue to be depressed is just incredibly another one of these really sort of bullish looking leading indicators. Because even if, you know, again, even if that end demand cools, businesses still want to make sure that they have stuff in their stock rooms, and, you know, for when that demand does return.
This is making finance fun, Sam. It feels like we're revealing toys on live TV here. I know you're also watching profit margins, and to me, listen, I'm surprised. Profit margins this year have remained so resilient. I mean, look at all the inflation we have seen: labor, cost of goods, you name it.
Yeah, no, this is probably, you know, one of the crazier stories of the year. And you know, you guys were just talking about, you know, what's been going on with the stock market and how it's been surging. And, you know, behind stock prices is earnings, and, you know, underlying those earnings is profit margins. And when profit margins are strong, all things being equal, you know, that earnings growth is going to be a lot more robust. And so, yeah, it's really incredible, especially with so many executives and businesses and, you know, trade group representatives and stuff, you know, all year has been screaming about inflation and how rising costs of goods and rising wages and all these things that are, you know, pressuring costs, you know, ultimately didn't affect the profit margins, because of, you know, there, you know, there's a number of things going on with these companies. You know, they're figuring out how to squeeze more productivity out of, you know, the few people that they have working for them. I mean, you know, again, we just talked about job openings, right? They're still figuring out how to, you know, deliver goods, even though, you know, they're sort of stretched for capacity. So they're getting more, you know, operating efficiency out of their existing businesses as demand returns. But the other thing that, you know, is just one of the more triggering, upsetting things that people hear about is companies have pricing power, that they are raising prices and they're passing these increased costs off to their customers, and the customers are taking it. And, you know, we've you know, read all the stuff about, you know, higher incomes and rising wages, obviously, excess savings, and then, you know, corporate cash piles and stuff. The, you know, customers, businesses, consumers, you know, they're going to be really upset about, you know, how much the price of what they're buying has gone up, but they're buying it anyways. And that's something that's come through in retail sales data. It came through in today's consumer spending data. It's just incredible. And, you know, corporations are very smart about this. They are aware of, you know, what's going on with their customers. And so they're raising prices and, you know, the sales are holding up. And so they're going to keep doing that until, you know, they get some actual pushback.
It's interesting. You mentioned all the different constituents that have sort of been noticing that. Congress has been noticing it too. We've gotten a little bit of political rhetoric around that also. But the thing is, as I look at that profit margins chart, you can't help but think it's going to keep expanding next year. I mean, we've been talking about peak profit margins, right? We talked about that earlier this year. But if component prices, if inflation on the wholesale level actually starts to go down, which there are plenty of predictions that it will at some point, and these companies don't cut their prices, those profit margins are only going to expand, right?
Well, I think the way, this is something that's been coming up with a lot of, you know, the strategists, you know, 2022 outlook notes, that, you know, everything from relief on the supply chains, jobs being filled, you know, all these things that, you know, become a little bit more disinflationary. And, you know, of course, we're also talking about, you know, tapering QE at an accelerated rate and the Fed raising interest rates potentially next year. All these things are, there's a lot of, you know, forces that seem that look like they're going to bring some relief to cost pressures. But I'm not quite sure that necessarily means that profit margins are going to, you know, continue to expand or hold up. It's possible that, you know, if costs do start to come down, then, you know, businesses, you know, as they look to, you know, steal market share from their competitors, might get more competitive when it comes to pricing so that they can just get a bigger share of the market. So, I think profit margins ends up becoming a wild card. But I think what's going on with elevated profit margins right now is probably, you know, companies, you know, trying to, you know, be a little bit cautious, even though it means, you know, potentially foregoing on stealing market share from their competitors.
You know, Sam, you're up 24/7 pretty much studying markets and stocks. What's the biggest thing you learned about markets this year, or just reminded about markets?
I think probably the most interesting. I mean, there were two things that really, you know, kind of jumped out this year. Bank of America strategist Savita Subramanian, you know, had this really nice quote, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and she said that something along the lines of, it's dangerous to wager against corporate America. So just like we were talking about with, you know, profit margin and pricing power and, you know, all these different things where there's this huge acceleration in earnings growth, is that businesses will figure out a way to conduct business and grow and, you know, enhance shareholder value. So that's one thing that I think was a good lesson for everybody. And the second thing is that, you know, consumers are just relentless when it comes to consumption, right? Like, again, even if it's, you know, there might be inflation, there's, you know, a pandemic out there. There's, you know, I think, you know, particularly when we saw the Delta variant, you know, earlier in the fall, And, you know, this was an incredibly, you know, dangerous variant of COVID. But during that period, we saw, not only did we see retail sales continue to grow, but they grew at rates that you know, far exceeded economists' expectations. And, you know, all that goes to show is that, you know, people, you know, regardless of the dangers of what's going on out there, you know, they're going to try to figure out a way to live their life and consume and experience those experiences, because I don't know what it is. Maybe there's a YOLO or life is short factor, but don't underestimate, you know, businesses' ability to adapt, and don't underestimate consumers' sort of hunger to consume.
Maybe they can pick up a sweet vintage Dr. No poster too. I'm feeling a little inspired by your decor, Sam. Sam Rowe, and Sam, did I say ticker.co, yes? I said it wrong, didn't I?
You know, I don't think there's really a wrong way to say it, but lately I've been pronouncing it as ticker. It started as T-K-E-R, but now it's ticker.
Okay, ticker, editor of ticker. Sam Rowe, it is always such a pleasure repping that beautiful swag this morning from ticker.co, our one-time owned Sam Rowe. Oh, you'll always be our own Sam Rowe. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, and happy holidays, Sam. Well, secondary market sales have been a big and rising trend even before the pandemic, and things, like many things, sort of accelerated amidst the pandemic. Let's bring in Jesse Einhorn. He is StockX chief economist. Of course, that's a secondary market initially primarily known for sneakers, but now has expanded to a number of other items as well. And Jesse, I want to ask you about holiday spending on StockX, because, you know, kind of the old school traditional way of thinking is you wouldn't buy something either that somebody else had owned, although in many cases the stuff on StockX is pretty pristine, right? And people have bought it to resell it. But what kind of holiday trends are you guys seeing?
Yeah, so everything that trades on StockX, right, is in dead stock condition. It's in 100% mint, brand new condition. So that's the first thing. But the trends we're seeing were, you know, a lot of trends that we already expected. For instance, you know, we're seeing a huge surge of demand around the Jordan 11 Cool Gray that released about a week ago. It is an iconic colorway of a very rare Jordan silhouette for people like me who grew up in the 90s watching Jordan play. It just hits that sweet spot of nostalgia and price point. And it's been a massive hit on StockX. It's just one of the best sellers we've seen in a very, very short amount of time. We're also seeing collaborations, out-of-the-box collaborations from brands like Yeezy and The Gap score really big. There's a line of hoodies that Kanye West did with The Gap that are some of the top-traded apparel items on the site. We've got collectible toys like the Tesla Hot Wheels collectible, which is like a smaller version of the Cybertruck. That's selling really well. Again, kind of a nostalgia play for people who want to go back and play with Hot Wheels, but also want an updated look on that toy. So those are some of the trends we're seeing. Again, nothing super unexpected. These are all products that were selling really well before the holiday season, and now they're just selling better than ever.
Jesse, this stuff ain't cheap. What's your read on the health of the U.S. consumer?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, there's been a ton of concern about supply chain. There's been concern about inflation. And in both of those cases, I think secondary markets provide an interesting release valve and an alternative to traditional retail shopping. And they aren't as vulnerable to the same kind of pressures and disruptions that we've seen in traditional retail, right? So when you've got a secondary marketplace that's powered by buyers and sellers, you know, 200 countries around the world and tens and thousands of them all negotiating at once, you know, it really allows for a much more efficient market pricing consumer experience. And so I think what you're seeing with the pandemic and all of these disruptive forces that a lot of people are exploring e-commerce and more specifically secondary markets as a way to do their holiday shopping and buy the things that they want.
And Jesse, you were talking about these sort of efficient marketplace here, but I imagine sometimes that efficiency can still push prices higher, right? If there's enough demand and not enough supply. So are you guys seeing the same kinds of inflation trends in a secondary market as we are seeing in primary markets of all kinds?
I mean, absolutely. At the end of the day, right, these we're dependent upon products that have to come from the primary market, right, that have to come at retail. But at the secondary level, right, what you have when you have thousands of buyers and sellers undergoing what is essentially a negotiation every single day, right? You know, that's what bidding and that's what people on StockX do, right? It's essentially like tens of thousands of little negotiations that take place every single day around every single product. And what that means is that even though the prices may be, you know, a bit higher than retail, they are the efficient market price, right? And people that buy on StockX can buy with confidence, knowing that the price they're paying is at least the market price. And that's in some ways much more efficient than, you know, a single retailer determining what the price is, right? It's much harder to game the system. It's much less vulnerable to certain inflationary pressures. And so, yes, some of the products are quite expensive, but I think what buyers really care about is just knowing that they're paying a fair price. And that's what you get on a secondary market like ours.
I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, has the fair price gone up from a year ago? I mean, I know it's hard because you're not necessarily selling all of the same product, right? But as far as you can tell, the apples to apples comparison you can make from now versus a year ago or 2 years ago, particularly, have you seen prices in general go up?
You know, not noticeably, not on StockX. And you know, if you look at, say, the Jordan 11 release that I spoke of earlier, that comes out every year. There's a big Jordan 11 release. It's almost always the biggest release of the year. It's almost always one of the top five sneakers that sell on StockX each year. And the price of that sneaker this year is right around what we've seen in terms of historical trends. And so, yes, there are some products that are a little more expensive. I think there are some products that are a little less expensive. The PlayStation, the Xbox, two really popular products on StockX are actually like a little bit lower in price right now because there've been a number of restocks on the primary market. You know, it could be that we just haven't seen that inflationary pressure trickle up or trickle down, depending on how you want to think about it, to the secondary market. But right now, prices are right about what you'd expect given historical trends.
Jesse, what are some of the biggest trends you see on tap for next year?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot more of these kind of collaborations that I spoke of earlier when I talked about, you know, Kanye West teaming up with The Gap. There's a lot of big legacy brands like The Gap, like Hot Wheels, you know, brands that have been around for decades, but want to reach this next gen, Gen X consumer, Gen Z consumers rather, Gen X as well, I suppose. And they're doing that by partnering with these of the moment artists like Kanye West, Cardi B in the case of Reebok, in the case of Hot Wheels, it's Tesla. You know, these are brands that are newer and fresher and have more appeal to a younger audience. So I think you're going to see more of these partnerships between legacy heritage brands and these new artists and new brands. And that's going to fuel a lot of the excitement and demand on the secondary market.
There's also a shoe purchase today that caught our eye. I don't know if you had a chance to see it, Jesse, but Crocs is buying a company called Hey Dude, which I hadn't even thought of. Frankly, I think the shoes look like sort of orthopedic, but I guess that fits in with Crocs. I don't know. How have things like Crocs been doing on the platform and this sort of quote unquote ugly shoe trend, if you will?
Yeah, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be casting aspersions on Crocs, but certainly they've had a reputation for being somewhat ugly. They're one of the most shockingly impressive success stories we've seen on StockX over the last couple of years. It was a brand that was completely off our radar 2-3 years ago. It's now one of the 6 or 7 most popular brands on StockX. Crocs has partnered with, you know, and has done a lot of the collaborations that I was speaking of just in the last answer. They partner with Post Malone, with Chinatown Market, with The Grateful Dead, Luke Combs, a ton of really, you know, exciting and different artists. And they put out these products that people want and that trade for much higher, you know, much higher quantities on the secondary market than anything we'd seen in the past. And this is driving a lot of excitement on the primary market as well. So if you look at Crocs, the, you know, normal Crocs that sell, not these limited edition collabs, they're selling in much, much higher quantities and the company's doing really, really well. And that kind of shows the virtuous, you know, interdependence between primary and secondary market, right? These limited edition hype collabs help fuel excitement around a brand. And that allows the brand to thrive in all of its releases, not just its limited, more hyped releases. And so Crocs is pursuing that and executing that strategy just brilliantly. I think that's going to be something we're going to see, you know, in the next year is more brands like Crocs kind of follow that same model because it's worked out so well for them.
It has indeed. I know Brian Sozzi is a big fan of the story from a stock perspective, because we have seen that stock perform quite well. Jesse, thanks so much and happy holidays. Jesse Einhorn is StockX's chief economist.